Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of November. How do we produce better citizens? Our guest this hour has drawn from a fine mind, his own, and also experiences from schools in Washington, D.C. to neighborhoods in San Antonio, and develops a pragmatic approach to civic revitalization that builds upon developments in organizing, deliberation, civic education, and also public service. And he is our guest this hour of the program. It's all to be found in his just-released book, We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Promise of Civic Renewal in America. Peter Levine is with us, professor of citizenship and public affairs at Tufts University, director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. He's also the author of all kinds of books, including Reforming the Humanities, Literature and Ethics from Dante through Modern Times, and The Future of Democracy, Developing the Next Generation of American Citizens. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Those are all ways for you to reach us. And Professor Peter Levine, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. All right, what do we mean exactly? Because this can be a huge category. Civic engagement, it means more than voting. It means more than writing a letter to the editor. It means a lot, doesn't it?
Right, and since today's voting day, at least around here,
yes.
It's probably worth saying.
It's
yeah, it does include voting, I think, but only because when you vote, it's one way of addressing or trying to address public problems. And I think the core citizenship is working together with other people to address public problems.
Boy, do we have a lack of that right now. And when you talk about doing it together in small pockets all over the country, I guess we almost are forced to do that because heavens knows they're not doing it in Washington, are they?
Right. And you are probably doing it much more than average in Wisconsin. And I'm not just saying that to be polite, but we look at statistics a lot on civic engagement in the upper Midwest, including Wisconsin. Usually comes out close to the top.
You outline a series of very serious problems in this country and then take on examples of how people have addressed those serious problems. They are indeed very serious. Could we start with the prison population? We've done shows on this recently. Mm. It is huge in this country, isn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah. 2 million plus of our citizens in prison, totally unprecedented in our own history, totally incomparable in terms of the rest of the world. I mean, second is China, but they have five times as many people as we do, and they have a lot fewer people in prison. It's an unbelievable reality, considering we like to think of ourselves as a democracy, but 2 million of our people are in basically authoritarian lockdown.
And so you highlight what happened in Oklahoma when they realized they were spending an inordinately high amount of money on prisons.
Yeah, I mean, part of that story is that there were discussions across the state that involved a lot of different people, including people across the political spectrum. And once people talked in a fairly open way about the whole issue, they kind of realized that none of them wanted to see so many people in prison. And it gave the politicians a feeling that they were some space to reduce sentencing, because otherwise their assumption is that they'll get hammered for being soft on crime.
Was this led by the League of Women Voters?
Yes, I believe they played a key part in it.
And so part of what they did was to reduce certain kinds of felonies to misdemeanors.
Yeah, and they also gave local boards of citizens some discretion in making sentencing decisions. Which is interesting because it involves more people in the criminal justice process.
When you look at the pockets of people around the country, or maybe it's more than just pockets, who are deliberating on these important issues like crime and like education, like health care issues, there are a whole host of serious issues. Do you find that it's just a minuscule number of people who are doing this, Peter, or is it larger than we would imagine?
Well, you know, in the book, I set a really high standard for what it means to be a truly good citizen, so I'm very tough about it. And I still think that at least 1 million and probably more Americans reach that standard every year. So that's a really low percentage. There's 300 million Americans, so 1 million is a very low percentage. But it's a lot of people, and it probably includes a lot of people who are listening to an NPR show. And so it includes probably a lot of people who are listening. And the thing is, there's real power in those numbers.
Somebody, we were doing a show last week on public radio, and somebody called in and said that, you know, this was all pie in the sky, our desire to have discussion about serious issues, that, for heaven's sake, the real radio is done by people like Rush Limbaugh, these entertainers, and we're fooling ourselves to think that there are people who care about all of these issues. But I think that that person was wrong. I wish everybody were listening to us instead of to Rush Limbaugh, to tell you the truth. But there are a group of people who are deeply, deeply committed. It's one of the reasons I love working here, to all of these issues that are the issues of our times.
Right. And I would just say it's not ideological simply either. So Rush Limbaugh is bad. I'll just say that. But it's not so much because he's far to the right, but it's also because he's got a completely one-directional conversation. He's just talking, and maybe he has some guests on, but they agree with him. But what I'm advocating, and I'm sure most listeners want, is a real discussion where you have multiple points of view and
right.
people are willing to listen. And I'll just, I mean, I have actually been on a fair amount of conservative talk radio about this book, and I've gotten exactly that reception. It certainly hasn't been Rush Limbaugh, who wouldn't know about it and would hate it, but I have been on conservative talk radio, and I've enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was somebody in the book you highlight, the woman who started the coffee party, who was tired of it. This is what gets tedious, is people yelling at each other and being really unkind to each other. There's not much place for that if you're going to be civically engaged or really care about all these issues. So she started this coffee party. It's an interesting story.
Right, and I don't know how much political legs it has.
Right.
It seems like it's faded a little, but I do think, or maybe it hasn't, maybe it's just under the radar, but I do think there's an appetite for civility, and I love the definition. I think it's the Cleveland City Club that has the definition. Civility is, I'm interested in what you have to say, and I'll act like that.
Oh, so I like that.
Civility is not so much just being polite or nice, because you can express emotion, but it's actually being interested in what the other person says.
Mm-hmm. You talk about what some of our political leanings are and what's wrong with them, libertarian-leaning conservatives, what they see as the problems, and then you look at liberal-leaning Americans, and you might be more in tune or more sympathetic to what some of their concerns are. But what's wrong with adopting one of those philosophies that, you know, we can say government is bad for this reason? It's too big, or we look to government to take on some of these problems?
Well, I mean, I'll admit that I'm personally liberal, and it is election day. I'm going to vote for liberal candidates, but I've actually struggled pretty hard myself against certain tendencies in mainstream liberalism, which are, I think, in part a lack of trust and faith in ordinary people to be part of solutions. So, I mean, I was on the Education Policy Committee of the Obama campaign in 2008.
Oh, you were?
Those were terrific people. They were better, more, the other people on the committee were, you know, more informed and smarter than I was about education. But I think very few of them wanted to see parents or other community members involved in schools. They didn't trust them. They thought that that would mean all kinds of, you know, of getting rid of studying evolution, just doing creationism or whatever. So they've had a fundamental distrust of the American people. And I was very struck because the to-be president, Senator Obama, was out on the campaign trail talking about engaging the American people. And we are the ones we've been waiting for. And that wasn't what you heard from the liberal technocratic education committee.
Mm-hmm. Schools you consider to be a serious problem in this country. God knows there are all these different ideas about what we need to do to improve them. They're all over the place, and some of them call for changing our system of education fairly radically. Why do you label it as a serious problem that needs a very careful citizen engagement?
Right. So there's two parts of that. Why is it a problem? Because about a third, almost a third of our kids are not actually completing high school, are dropping out. Estimates vary, but it's probably up to 30-35%. So, you know, in an age when you need at least high school to be successful economically, we just can't have 30% of our kids not making it through high school. That's the problem. Why do we need people? Because I think the evidence is really, really strong that when citizens are involved supporting education with their dollars, but also with their work and their attention and feeling that schools belong to them, results are much, much better. And none of the quick fixes by either the right or the left, neither spending more money nor privatizing nor tests, none of them work if the public isn't directly involved in schooling.
So where is that happening, and what are the results?
It happens in some places. It's happened, for example, in the book I talk about Bridgeport, Connecticut, which went from a total basket case to having a pretty strong school system. So it does happen in some places. When you look across the whole country, the states and cities which have more civic engagement have better schools, and that's after you consider that the effects of things like spending and economics.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty strong pattern.
You look at a city like Washington, D.C., where there are a lot of government people. There are people who are concerned about issues. And then you talk about the public schools where there are a lot of poor kids who are going to school there. Has this created kind of a two-tier system where you have private schools educating most of the people who are in government and public schools, which have been thought to be not very good, educating people who do the other kinds of work for the government that aren't as prominent?
Right. I mean, it's not really, exactly. It's not really government versus non-government because, as you know, in D.C., where I used to live for many years, the working class also works for the government,
right.
delivering letters and stuff. So it's actually, I would say, just simply a class division. The wealthy don't send their kids, for the most part, to public schools, and the poor definitely do send their kids to public schools. So there are two systems for sure. And, of course, that's true also in New York and San Francisco.
So is there civic engagement at work in that city to make the public schools better?
Well, there has been some over the years, but I talk about it in the book partly because it's also been – D.C. has just been a plaything for various education reform strategies that don't involve people. So, and most famously, the Chancellor Michelle Rhee, who was shown on the front cover of Time magazine with a broom sweeping out the waste and corruption from the school system. She said that public engagement is overrated. She said literally public engagement is overrated. And, you know, she was taking a top-down strategy, which was – it had nothing to do with engaging the public.
And as you know, there's a fierce debate going on in places like Wisconsin and other states as to whether or not private schools can do the job much better than public schools. Some would say that there's an attack on public education and perhaps a movement to move to something that is quite different. How are people civically engaged in that particular issue? It's a very big issue, I think, for this country. Is there true deliberative, what's best for our children, what's best for our community? Is this highly political debate that's going on? What is it?
Right. Well, I mean, I do think people are entitled to a variety of views about something like, should we have vouchers? Of course, Wisconsin, Milwaukee was the famous test case. I mean, that you can be a good citizen and think we should have vouchers. There are good arguments for it. So I think, you know, that's the kind of thing we have a democracy to debate and so a variety of points of view are fine. I am interested, though, at a different level in which schools actually engage their communities in educating their kids, and especially a diverse community, if that's possible. We've never been very good at that in the U.S. because our schools have always been badly segregated, but a perfect school to me is one that has a diverse set of kids and the parents are actually involved in the school.
Mm-hmm. Are there many of those, Peter, in the country?
Well, I mean, at one level, I think a lot of your average suburban schools are not so bad at that. And so some of the rhetoric about how our education system is terrible is overblown because in some ways the average kid isn't getting such a bad deal. There are also some wonderful urban schools which have achieved that. But on the whole, I think parents feel squeezed out of schools worse than they did 30 years ago.
Well, let's go back to Bridgeport for a moment, because you describe it in the book as being a basket case in the 1980s. The city filed for bankruptcy, for heaven's sake, in 1978. And now you say that it's at the point where its school system was one of five finalists for the National Broad Prize. Is that it? For urban education in 2006 and 2007. What did they do?
So the argument in the book, I'm sure there were many factors, but the thing I wanted to highlight in the book was that they had organized broad-based discussions throughout the city that tapped all kinds of people, you know, kids, teachers, parents, but also the business community, faith community, the university. And by having those conversations and taking their time and organizing them and facilitating them so that they weren't shouting matches, they really built a lot of consensus. So the business community was willing to invest more money in the schools, but the schools were willing to change their priorities. And ordinary people were willing to volunteer time, so they have a very strong volunteering rate. But I think, you know, volunteering isn't good enough, or it's not satisfying enough if all you're doing is giving hours at some place that you don't control. this was people volunteering because they felt that they had a stake in the schools and the schools were listening to them.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to the issue of, I almost hate to say it because everybody's going to just say, I love it or I hate it or give it a chance. Healthcare reform. We heard during the news that the website is up and running as of today, which is interesting. But, oh, my gosh, here's an issue, and you know this is better than anybody, where everybody agreed not that long ago, people in business, and people who are trying to get health care and people who have been pushed off systems and people whose co-pays were going way up, that everybody would sit at the table and say, we've got a problem here. This system is not helping people as it should, and it's way too expensive. And yet you try to have some kind of deliberative action about it, and look what's happened, for heaven's sake. It stopped government. What did we do wrong?
Yeah, well, we are a bitterly divided country. By the way, I'm glad to hear the website works. I find out by being on your show. That's good news. But, you know, and I'm a supporter of the bill, but without being an expert on healthcare, for sure, I think I'm very hopeful that it will work. But I think, you know, we're in a bitterly divided political environment. It's easy to game the political system. It's easy to manipulate the media. It paid off to score outrageous points against the administration. But on the other side, the administration didn't think of anything creative to do to harness the enthusiasm of ordinary Americans for this,
right. You're right.
For this reform.
What should they have done?
Well, I think they had several options, and you know, one of them would have been relatively partisan, which is that they had all these foot soldiers in the 2008 campaign who had volunteered for the president, and they basically sent them home the next day. They could have sent them out there fighting for health care reform. So that would have been the kind of partisan approach. A much more, and I'm not against it, it would have been engaging and probably beneficial. But a more bipartisan approach would have been to have some kind of national deliberation about health care reform, which I think if they had structured right and started off well in 2009, could have really been a good conversation.
Well, we could still have that deliberation about why in the world the cost of health care is so much higher in this country than it is in most other countries on Earth, right?
Yes, and I say, because people will probably think I'm being way pie in the sky by talking about this national deliberation, but there actually have been good conversations, organized conversations, and open conversations about health care in various places. They had them in California. And people do come down with sensible conclusions when they're in a room with people, with actual other human beings, not getting barraged by mass media thinking about it, and they actually have good ideas. And they would probably come down with something that was at least as aggressive as the president's strategy.
So can you work at a state level or at a community level and have any kind of influence on those issues that you outlined that in many cases, particularly with health care reform, are being decided at the national level? I mean, isn't there a disconnect here?
There is, and I want to say the book is, you know, the book is partly angry, so it's not. This is not a book about everything. You just roll up your sleeves and be a good citizen, and everything will be fine because mm-hmm. they solved the problem in Bridgeport. I mean, there's brutal national politics, partisan and driven by money and just bad. I do think that enough people have experience doing good civic work, mostly at the local level, that if we can organize ourselves to push for better national politics, we have quite a lot of power collectively.
And how do we do that? We do that on the internet? What method of communication do we use?
The internet helps, but for sure. And I think the new democracy of the 21st century is going to be very digital. It's not going to look like the democracy of the 19th century. But I think the most important step is for people, and at this point I'm really talking to listeners. I bet a lot of people listening are involved in civic work in a particular community or a particular domain. So they're in, you know, Madison or Eau Claire, or they're working in education reform or environment. And I think it's time for us to kind of look up and recognize that there are other people also doing civic work, also frustrated by the same factors that are frustrating us. And it's time for us to work together to change those conditions.
And we'll talk more about how people do that in a moment. Our guest this hour is Peter Levine. His book is We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Promise of Civic Renewal in America. We're welcoming phone calls. Perhaps you have, I'm sure many of you do, listening, have examples of what's happening in the state of Wisconsin that really fits the bill when it comes to civic engagement on very important issues where you feel as though you have made a difference what are the forces at work that keep that from happening? Why is it that there aren't more Bridgeports, there aren't more Allentowns, there aren't more places where Oklahoma, where work has been done on serious issues and policy has been changed, education, et cetera? Why is it so much a battle in this country? Is there another way to go about addressing our issues? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And our guest again is Peter Levine. He is professor of citizenship and public affairs at Tufts College of Citizenship and Public Service. And he is director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. He's the author of a number of books. To your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your phone calls now for Peter Levine. 800-486-8655 is the number. And we start our calls with Pat in Richland. Hi, Pat.
Well, good afternoon, and I'll tell you what, I share Mr. Levine's optimism because I believe that our fellow Americans vastly, majority, really, really do value some fundamental fairness. You know, we're not talking no capitalism here, but, and with people want to do the right thing, and if they're given something at the local level that they know they can do that'll make a difference. Actually, the demonstrations in Madison's a couple winters ago. I listen. I'm coming at this a little bit different. I listen every day to quite a bit of Rush Limbaugh and all the right wing radio shows. I'll swear to God, there's not that many people listening to those guys, but they're doing their job. If they can get a lot of people like us thinking that. You know, tons of Americans are listening and agreeing to that. It's all about being mean and greedy, and that is not human nature.
Peter.
Beautiful. I'm glad to hear it. I would point to lots of great examples. I don't know if anybody's... Do you reach Eau Claire?
Sure.
Yeah, because Vision Eau Claire, some friends of mine are working on that as a citywide effort to kind of to plan and to think of the future in Eau Claire and to draw on everybody's... you know, ideas. And I think when people are given that kind of opportunity, they are excited and grateful.
Thank you very much, Pat, for your call. Steve in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the one thing I noticed that, you know, I read the newspapers and read all the comments that people put in, and they get quite the trolley in there. There's a lot of anger sometimes, but I think that if the people on the left and the people on the right sort of acknowledged each other's humanity and said, you know, I know that you don't want bad things to happen to our community, and sort of really looked at each other as neighbors and members of this community rather than members of the left, the sort of amorphous mass, or the right, this sort of huge thing, but rather you're the guy that lives down the street from me, and we have local issues we need to solve. And I think that I feel like that's what's missing, is people don't really acknowledge each other's humanity when they're having these political discussions.
Do you feel
for what it's worth?
Do you feel, Steve, like you have a sense of community in Chippewa Falls?
Well, I moved here a year and a half ago. And yeah, I do. I mean, I kind of walked right into the middle of the recall election, and I really didn't feel like I had a dog in that fight. You know, but it was just amazing to see the sort of anger on both sides, and I think that's eased back a bit, but. But I do think there's something to be said for you know not saying, well, you're trying to starve poor children if you're concerned about the level of food stamps. You know, I think we all are very concerned about the welfare of children in our community, and I think that we need to acknowledge that to one another and then go on with the conversation, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Do I feel a sense of community? I do. Yes, I do.
Good. Good. I'm glad. Peter.
Of course, one thing that's precious today and not very common is actually communities where people live near each other and disagree. We've sorted ourselves out pretty well into conservative
yes.
and liberal communities. Wisconsin's still purple as a state, but I think you're segregated internally. And, and I have to confess, I mean, most of my neighbors on my block agree with me anyway, so it's easy for me to acknowledge their humanity because we also vote the same way. A little harder for me to acknowledge that I might be wrong and that someone very different from me might be right and that that person is also a fellow citizen.
Right.
But I try.
Right. And has that happened to you?
It has. I think it's honestly, it's relatively rare, and it seems at this day and age either to take deliberate efforts of listening and outreach and trying to remember that other people are who are different from you are your fellow citizens, or some structured opportunity. I mean, when if you're invited to come out to some kind of event where there'll be a disagreement, I think a fair number of people will actually take up that invitation and show up.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Steve. In Chippewa Falls, Eric Kenosha. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I don't think the civility in politics really comes from the politicians. They're just reflecting what we as citizens in the media portray. You know, you've got situations like the Trayvon Martin case where MSNBC and NBC were editing tapes to put a, you know, an uncivil spin against anybody who disagreed with them. Kind of like with anybody who disagrees with the politics of the president, you know, instead of saying, hey, we disagree about this subject, these are the issues we disagree on, it's an automatic knee-jerk reaction saying, well, if you disagree with the president, you must be a racist. And that seems to be a knee-jerk reaction that a lot of the major media outlets, such as Al Sharpton and MSNBC, seem to resort to.
And do they do it on the right as well, do you think? Eric?
Oh, it happens on both sides, but mm-hmm. Recently, it seems that there's this knee-jerk reaction to you have to protect the administration. That, you know, they don't want to see the president fail because everybody has so much invested. And it's both sides do it, but it seems to be a little bit more on the left in recent days because they have, you know, the person in office and they're trying to defend that.
Peter.
I don't know how to measure or weigh which side does it worse, but I'm not sure that's a fruitful thing to try to measure. But I do think that the political climate in Washington D.C. reflects A, the media, and B, us. I mean, it is we do vote for those guys, and we do tolerate the way they act. And you know, it's partly their fault, but it's partly our fault. And part of it is that most Americans no longer have experience in deliberative settings where we're trying to decide what to do together as a group. We used to, because we used to have many more school boards, local government bodies of all kinds, PTAs, where you had to show up and you knew people were not going to agree with you, but you had to come up with a budget and you had to learn things like what makes a good discussant, who is using up too much time, who's being obstreperous, who's just alienating people. And then when you had those experiences, you could look at Congress and you could say, that person, you know, I kind of agree with him, but he's a terrible deliberator. I want someone who acts with some civility and so on. And I think the reason we don't pick people like that anymore is because we don't have day-to-day experience with that kind of with deliberation.
Hmm. Well, the other thing, thank you very much, Eric, for the call. The other thing, and let's spend a little bit of time talking about this, and you write about it. There are certain issues that really get to people. I mean, they just feel darn strongly about them, and they may get animated in the way they discuss things. And to them, it's an issue of right or wrong, and there are morality issues involved here. So you entertain this question, and I want to know what your answer is to it. Some proponents, you write, of civic renewal are themselves angry about corruption and inequality and believe that stirring up anger in themselves and others is an appropriate response. And you say calls for civility can be efforts to silence marginalized and legitimately resentful citizens that's been used during the civil rights struggle and other struggles. So how do you factor that in?
Right. Yeah, I mean, this conversation right here on the show has gone a little bit too strongly towards civility as the core thing. Because,
right.
Because, I mean, I'd like to think I'm a civil guy, and I think there is a value to it. And part of the value is that if you really recognize that other people might be right and you might be wrong, then that puts you in a civil frame of mind because you're actually listening, which I think is very valuable. And then we also need to do some repair work. So if the state is going to be divided because of a recall election and it's very close, then the state does have to go on after the recall election and mm-hmm. people do have to treat each other as fellow human beings. So repair work is good. So having said those two things, though, I'm not against eruptions of anger, because that's part of democracy, too. And if we suppress that, it's just not fair. So if you did want to recall the governor, or you passionately supported the governor, I'm not saying you shouldn't have been part of that. And I think that the protests in the Wisconsin state capitol were a civic uprising, but I would want also to have, then there's a vote and it's over, and then I would also want to have civic repair work.
And how would you do that? How do you do civic repair work?
Well, a lot of times it really is work, I think. So that's something else we haven't talked about. We've been talking as if citizenship was all about talking, about listening, talking, but not about rolling up your sleeves and doing stuff. And I actually think the best kinds of citizenship involve doing stuff. So, you know, a PTA doesn't just have a meeting. A PTA then actually raises money, spends money. People roll up their sleeves and actually clean up the playground. And that's citizenship, too. And I think when you clean up the playground together with somebody who maybe disagrees with you is when you really get a sense of being fellow citizens.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Joanne in West Allis. Hello.
Hello, and thank you. I just wanted to share a comment that I heard a while ago from Rick Warren, who wrote The Purpose-Driven Life. He was on Meet the Press, and the host asked him, incidentally, if he was right-wing or left-wing. And he said, I'm neither wing. The bird needs both wings to fly. Hmm. And I just thought that was a good way to put it.
Right. Yeah, so you can be, that's a great metaphor, because you can be one of those wings or the other when it's time, when it's the right time. For example, when you vote, you got to vote for one side or the other side. And yet you can also recognize that it takes the two wings to fly.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a few minutes talking about young people. I know that you've been involved, your organization, CIRCLE, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, that you have been a part of the movement to increase youth voter turnout. Let's expand that a little and talk about getting future generations engaged in caring about issues and in taking action on issues. How do we do that for each new generation, Peter?
Well, one thing is anybody who's involved in civic life in general, running an organization, running for office, just being part of the community life, you've got to pay attention to the next generation, because they're the future. And so you've got to make sure that they're included. And if they're not showing up or part of what you're doing, then you have to roll up your sleeves and figure out what to do about that, not just blame them, for example. For one thing, this is a pretty attractive generation in many ways, very idealistic, very high volunteering rates, highest ever recorded. So
really?
They pretty much, yes. There's nothing wrong with them in a statistical sense. They're not worse than previous generations. They're actually a little better in terms of volunteering. But they may not be showing up, let's say, to the town meeting, city council meeting, school board. And if you're responsible for those things, you have to get them there. And that means inviting them, making the whole thing accommodating to them, feeling like making them feel like they count.
Mm-hmm. Well, it may mean free food, too.
Yeah. So that's the heart of civil society, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
Chocolate cake.
Right.
Mary in Eau Claire. There we go. We got a good Eau Claire caller for you. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just want to say this. I got very involved in civic affairs for the first time and on a small county advisory board because of the water issues related to frack sand mining. And so I was very disturbed by Senator Tiffany's bill, SB 349, that was going to, that proposes taking away authority to regulate, most authority to regulate air and water from municipalities and counties. And I got to say, you know, after all this, you know, hard work organizing communities and, you know, getting people together and, you know, finally some of these people in the towns feel empowered and feel like they know what to do, I mean, that, and then to go to the hearings and have him listen to the Wisconsin Industrial Sand Association over and over again, it was truly extremely discouraging.
Peter.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's part of the problem. And I'm very sympathetic because this is hard to address. Part of it is that the kind of big players the well-funded interests and the people with lawyers and others working for them can usually figure out where they'd rather have the battle, you know, in Washington and in Madison and or in the local community, where do they think they'll win, and then they can move the battle where they want it. So I don't know anything about that bill, but it obviously was moving power from the local level to the state level, and it's probably because they thought they could win there. So that's tough, and we're not organized at the national level. We citizens are not very well organized at the national level, so we lose when they move it away. But then I think the other thing that's been going on for 100 years is basically a kind of denigration of local civic engagement, so that both the right and the left have bought into. So they're always trying to move decisions to bigger, more expert-driven bodies. And that means that the local engagement that the caller just talked about gets to be valueless, and mm-hmm. people feel that it's valueless, and they give up.
So what does
we need to fight it back against that.
So what does she do about it? What does Mary do?
Yeah. Well, certainly. Okay, so it's easy for me to say, but you got to keep fighting because people do win some of the time. But also, when they move the battle to a different location, then I think that's the point when you have to hook up with people in other places. So, you know, is there a nascent Wisconsin-wide movement working on fracking?
Thanks, Mary. Thanks for your call. David in Ironwood. Hello.
Yeah. What I get mad at is that too often they try to reduce anything to a two-second soundbite on the news and stuff. And you try to call in with good ideas, and they don't give you enough time to explain them. And, I mean, during 2000, I wrote both Congress, the Senate, and the representative about health care. And I had some good ideas that a lot of the doctors, a lot of the accountants and thought were great, and yet you know that they didn't listen to. You know, they told me to read their stuff, but they evidently didn't read anything I sent them. It's just that's what, I mean, they got to start listening to the people.
Peter?
Yeah, well, I certainly appreciate having a whole hour on your show because it's very against the
it
know,
is.
It's against the norm, which would have me on for 25 seconds to explain about engagement. Right.
How could you possibly talk about it in that amount of time?
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah. So it is a problem. But a lot of the best conversations are local and not necessarily face-to-face. I think you can have great conversations on the Internet, but they are more sustained. It does require taking time.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking this hour with the author of We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Promise of Civic Renewal in America. Peter Levine is our guest. Peter is a professor at Tufts College of Citizenship and Public Service, and he's director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. And we have two lines open right now. So feel free to join us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Or you can send an email, talk@WPR.org, or you can send a Facebook message, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, one of our hours, Colonel Chris Hadfield will join us, author of An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, What Going to Space Taught Me About Ingenuity, Determination, and Being Prepared for Anything. He captivated the world earlier this year. You're probably familiar with this when he released a series of gorgeous photographs and videos about life in space. He got over 10 million views in the first 3 days online and has received more than 16 million views to date. He's logged nearly 4,000 hours in space. He knows how to perform basic surgery in zero gravity, and he will be with us tomorrow during this hour. All right, let's go back to phone calls. What's encouraging is that this hour has sparked just a whole lot of conversation, which is a good thing. Jake in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, yeah, I think one of the biggest problems is the idea or the how ethics and principles, situational ethics and principles in our country. For example, in the state, when Jim Doyle was governor, the people on the right who didn't like him were like, oh, we want our local control back, blah, 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 blah. And then now when they're in control, they are even worse about taking local control away from municipalities, be it the frack sand mine bill. And the people on their side don't care. So they completely switched it, and they don't care. And vice versa, people who are against NSA spying when Bush was president, you know, have not spoke up as much as they have with Obama being president. And I just think that if people could stick to their principles a little bit more and not be so wishy-washy on them because they dislike the other person so much, I think things would be a lot better in this country and in the state because, you know, because it comes down to I have a bigger stick and club and I want to see my guy beat you with it and laugh, and then you end up finding out a couple of years later that you're hurting yourself as well. So that's all I got to say.
Thank you for saying it. Thanks, Jake.
Yep, that sounds right. I think there's a lot of kind of gaming, a lot of use of things like federalism or anti-federalist arguments, you know, making decisions locally or making decisions nationally just so that you can win. So the actual issue about whether decisions should be made nationally or locally is completely subservient to whether you think you can win, and people will switch sides. Another example is whether courts should override legislation. People love that when the courts will decide their way, and they hate it when the courts decide the other way.
Exactly. Let's take on another issue, and let's look at the issue that affects so many communities, and I know you've written about Allentown and Bridgeport and others in your book. Let's take on the issue of unemployment or underemployment, which I think is pervasive in this country, and most people would agree that jobs are good things. You need them, and they give your life definition and meaning and all of that. And yet it seems to be a problem that we can't address very well on a national level. So tell me about the communities or the way that people of goodwill who want to create jobs in their communities or have people be able to have family-supporting jobs, how to do that? How have communities done that particular issue?
Well, a lot of jobs got wiped out, of course, in 2008, 2009, and everybody's unemployment rate went up. But then in the years after, it was the cities and counties and towns that had more everyday civic engagement that recovered better, which is something that my colleagues and I studied and found pretty clearly. So places where people go to meetings, talk to neighbors, trust each other, vote, regardless of all the other factors that might affect unemployment, those communities did better. And we think there's a whole bunch of reasons for it. Government's better in those places, more responsive. Markets work better. Businesses are more likely to actually make investments locally when business people are part of their communities, aware of opportunities, hopeful about their communities, loyal to their communities. So the bottom line would be very important to make sure that you've got a strong everyday civic infrastructure if you want to build the economy.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about Allentown?
Right. So, well, the book uses work actually by another person, of course, Sean Safford, who wrote a great book, comparing Allentown and Youngstown, mm-hmm. two cities with very similar disastrous economic situations when the American steel industry collapsed. But the difference is that Allentown had a robust civic network composed of lots of people, including the unions and the corporations, who were able to meet on a kind of regular, informal basis, think about their situation, and figure out a whole range of strategies. And Allentown is doing pretty well now. Youngstown had none of that, so nobody was able to meet and talk and strategize and figure out solutions. And so Youngstown is very, very badly off now.
Hmm. Let's go to Sandy in Appleton next. Hello.
Hi. Well, I think meetings are great, but I think from my experience, there should be more feedback from the children themselves, and I'm all for sending home a questionnaire, possibly 4 times a year, to find out what's going on. This might knock down the suicide rate somewhat.
Feedback from children, I'm sorry, at school?
Yeah, feedback from the children at school, what their problems are, what their problems are having with their teachers. I know we had, I could fill a page. bad things happening with the teachers that nobody knew about. So I think if we were getting some feedback from the children, this would really help.
Mm-hmm. In Boston, where I live, a bunch of kids got a policy through, and they got the union and the school board to support it, in which every child fills out a constructive feedback form on every teacher. Hmm. And the form doesn't say, did you like the teacher or was it a good teacher, because kids will not give you good information there. But it asks questions like, how long did it take after the bell rang for the class to get started? And how many kids participate in the conversation, in the discussion, and how many kids does the teacher call on, and how much homework did you get? And that data is actually extremely useful for the teachers and the principals to assess what's going on in the classrooms. The whole thing came from the kids themselves. They also wrote the questionnaire.
Yeah, you know, we don't listen. She makes such a valid point that we tell kids what to do, but we really don't listen carefully and deliberately to what young people have to say about what's going on, and we should.
Yeah, and we find that when kids feel that they have a responsible voice in their own school, when they feel that a kid who raised a valid issue would get a hearing, the schools perform better, and the kids become better citizens.
Thanks, Sandy. We go to Mary next in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for your wonderful show. I just turned on the radio. We left a celebratory lunch because... and I got in the car, and I heard someone talking about, they were lamenting the fact that the county board or the city council was just listening to the sand industry and not listening to the people. The reason we were celebrating at lunch today in Milwaukee is because the city council passed a resolution this morning unanimously, 15-0, to get a referendum on the ballot, to ask the people what we think about money in politics. Moved to Amanda, of southeast Wisconsin, and what we did was we have a referendum that says we want a U.S. constitutional amendment that says money isn't speech and a corporation isn't entitled to constitutional rights. This would do more than reverse the Citizens United decision of 2010, but it would really get money out of politics, and it would enable us to curb some of the powers that these very big corporations, not the little ones are suffering, but the big corporations are monopolizing our airwaves, our legal system, our elections, and so we wanted to change that. So the Milwaukee Common Council passed that, and if the state law, AJR, Assembly Joint Resolution 50, doesn't put it on the ballot in the year 2014 in November, and if the county doesn't put it on the ballot, which we're trying to do all of that, then this resolution said that the city would do it. So we're having some good success here in Wisconsin, but it isn't really on the radar of most of the media because they're larger corporations, unlike your show, where you also really listen to the citizenry. So I just wanted to tell you about that because I think it's wonderful that the city council is listening to us and wants to know what we think.
Thank you so much, Mary, for the call. Peter, sound good to you?
It sounds great, and I just want to say, because I'm one of the people who, you know, goes around talking about good citizenship and works on that topic, and I'm even the professor of citizenship at Tufts, but I don't believe people are going to be better citizens if the political system is stacked against them, and I do think the political system is stacked against us, and things like campaign finance reform are therefore essential if we're going to have good citizens.
Well, we could take on the issue of money in so many regards, right? It's just, holy Toledo, who's got it, who doesn't have it, who wants it, how it's guiding our college choices, our Harvard graduates, they're going to Wall Street, you know, who's got the power, who's got the voice. It's omnipresent.
It creates tremendous inequalities, including inequalities of political power, but it also debases what should count in citizenship. So if you can, you know, have a voice in politics because you've got money and are spending it, that says that citizenship is like a purchase.
Yeah.
It's like a transaction. So it debases what should be our core value.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter, thank you so much. It was really an interesting, just tons of phone calls. You should be encouraged by that.
Good.
Yeah, you're on to something, sir.
Good. Good.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for being with us. Peter Levine, We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For is the name of the book, The Promise of Civic Renewal in America. He's a professor in public affairs at the College of Citizenship at Tufts University and Public Service, and also the director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. A reminder, tomorrow we're going to be talking about why tribes have gone the route of casinos in order to make their communities stronger, and if there are alternatives to that as a source of income, and why it's been such a big source of income for so many tribes. And we'll also, of course, talk to that astronaut. So that should be good, Helen. Great conversations ahead. Thanks to Ron, Robin Cherry, and KP Whaley, and Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour.